This is America Weekend. I am Paul Harris, and now we're going to talk about poker with Molly Bloom, who ran the highest stakes poker games in L.A. for some of the biggest names in L.A. and writes about it now in a book called Molly's Game. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed reading this book, particularly because I'm a poker player and because I've actually played in games at the Commerce Casino with Ben Affleck and Tobey Maguire. And I played in Vegas with one-time world champion Jamie Gold. And Nelly, who I know played in some of your games, is a regular in the games that I play in here in St. Louis.
And, oh, yeah, that's right.
And
awesome.
So I've got a little bit of a connection here.
You got a lot of a connection.
Well, yeah. One of the things that I have to start with here is Tobey Maguire, who, you know, really good actor, really good poker player, really greedy jerk.
You said it.
Explain to my audience why I'm saying that, though.
You know, at a table, he's just out for blood, and he's keeping track of every penny and looking for any way he can to make more.
Not only is he trying to make money off the other players, he actually pushed you out of the game you were running.
Yes, he did.
And also had a piece of equipment, a shuffling machine that he had. And actually, even though he was making millions of this game, didn't he try to rent that to you?
Yes, he insisted we used it, which, you know, I think was probably, in retrospect, a good decision. But then upon insisting we use it, he told me he was going to charge rent. And then he raised the rates the next year. He was like a shuffle master slumlord.
The shuffle master machine gives you the ability to play more hands, so everybody gets a little bit more action. And that's really what it was about for some of these guys. Not only did you have a good celebrity like Ben Affleck or Tobey Maguire in the game, you also had some real degens like Rick Solomon, who is known for exactly one thing, and that is the Paris Hilton sex tape. And you had other guys who poured hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars into this game, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Did it seem like it hurt them at all?
Not until around 2008 when some of the real estate guys, you know, it seemed like they were getting hurt from their jobs. But most of these guys that played in this game could afford tremendous losses.
Yeah, but I know that every poker player hates to see that river card that kills them, that two outer that means they lost their stack, and that has to affect even rich guys.
It does affect rich guys, but it's more about the loss than I think the actual the number. You know, look, the games got so big eventually that the kind of wins and losses, I don't care how rich you are, they're going to affect you. But I think it's also just, you know, it's an ego thing. You don't want to lose all the time. You want to win.
And when guys did lose, was it all men all the time?
It was all men all the time.
Okay. Yeah. That sounded weird, but you know what I mean.
I know. No. I understand.
When the guys would lose, how hard was it for you to collect?
It was challenging. You know, it was, there was a definite finesse to collections. I'm not an intimidating person, nor did I want to take that route. So it was just a lot of kind of, you know, posturing and letting them kind of come to me instead of chasing it all the time. And the thing that was really great was that I had this game that was so live and had so much action and so many draws in terms of the celebrities or the billionaires, and tons of business was getting done, and, you know, it became this iconic thing that people really wanted to come back. So in the LA game, it was much easier to collect than in New York.
This game was famous. Everybody who played poker anywhere in the country at some point heard about this game. I've never played at the kind of stakes that you did. Even when you had the low stakes game, that's a little bit too high for me. But people knew about this game, and in LA, particularly when you were running the game there, tons of people wanted to come and play. How did you choose who got the invitation?
I chose based on what it seemed like was the most well received at the table. It was either a celebrity or a sports star, or it was loose action, or it was somebody that, you know, was loose action and terrible.
Yeah.
And had a good personality. That was kind of the ideal.
Yeah. A famous person who played badly and didn't mind losing.
Yeah,
you are welcome in our game.
Yeah. You have a seat anytime you want.
Yeah. By the way, that's true at every poker table in the world.
Yeah, no, it is. It's, you know, it's just the culture.
But how did you keep the game secure and private? Tell me about the process of making sure that the people you didn't want to show up didn't show up?
Well, I eventually moved the games to, you know, the penthouse suites or you know, at the Four Seasons and the Beverly Hills Hotel or the Peninsula. And so I kind of used their security to protect the game. And a lot of people knew what was going on and in the hotel. But they're used to this kind of clientele in Los Angeles. They're used to the celebrities, and they were very discreet. And the people that I hired, I made sure they were discreet. And I kind of lived this double life for a long time where I didn't really talk about my life at all.
Yeah, you had to keep the game private and really secret from your entire world, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I also know that there were a lot of poker pros who heard about the game and wanted to get in there because they saw fish in the game and they were sharks.
Oh yeah, now this was a professional poker's wet dream.
How did you keep them out?
I mean, they approached me with all different kinds of offers, free rolls, straight cash, you know, but I knew that would be terrible for the game, you know, and it was just, it would have been a very short term gain. And, you know, this game was so perfect for so long because the pros weren't there. And there were just a lot of players that were, you know, close to equally skilled. And a lot of times the money just changed hands. And I think Toby always came out ahead. And I think I always came out ahead. And you know, other than that, people were having huge losses and huge wins. But, you know, it was pretty equal.
All right, we're back to Toby now, so I've got to ask, was there ever a consideration to not include him in the game because other players complained, this guy wins all the time and we're sick of it?
Well, it was interesting because I would have just kind of honored what the consensus wanted, and they complained all the time, and they complained about his etiquette at the table, but they still really wanted to play with him. And I think it just kind of speaks to the culture in L.A. and in other places in the world that we're just, you know, we're a little celebrity obsessed.
Yeah, I mentioned that I had a chance to play with him in a tournament at the Commerce in outside of L.A. long time ago, and it was right after Spider-Man had come out, and so he was a gigantic star. And he was sitting there very quietly with his hood pulled up and his hat pulled down, and Jen, who was then his fiancée, was sitting behind him very quietly. And it became very obvious as soon as I got moved to his table, he doesn't really want to talk.
No, he's there to win, to take your money.
Yeah, but when he was in the cash game, was he a talker?
Yes, he talked, but you know, it was really focused on poker. I write in my book that I used to call him Hannibal Lecter, which is actually kind of a compliment at a poker table because of that scene in Silence of the Lambs where Hannibal Lecter is actually able to talk someone into, you know, offing themselves in the next cell, because Toby could talk someone off at the top hand. You know, he could really spend time talking somebody off, you know, the nuts, which is, you know, the best hand in poker. So it was crazy.
Some people don't understand that what you were doing in running these poker games, at least the ones in L.A., were not illegal. Why?
Correct. I wasn't taking a cut. It was just based on tips. The players would tip me.
For those who don't know, when you go to a casino and you play, the casino takes a few dollars out of every hand. Usually up to $4, $5, $6, depending on where you're playing around the country. There are also home games around America where people take $5 out of the pot. I've heard of one in Houston where they take $30 out of every hand. That's a hard rake for the players to beat. I had heard for a while that your game had $100 a hand rake. Was that never true?
Never in L.A. No.
Okay, so doing it that way with no rake, no take for the house, meant it was a legal game. But then you move to New York because Toby essentially forced you out of L.A., and you end up in New York and get involved with some people who you probably shouldn't have gotten involved with, and they forced you to take a rake. Am I right?
You know, I think it wasn't, I can't say it was a forced situation. I made a decision at that point to take a rake for a couple different reasons, and, you know, when I moved to New York, I tried to scale this thing. You know, I had one game in LA and I had gotten pushed out, so I didn't want to make the same mistakes that I had made. And I was also getting a little bit greedy. You know, I wanted to really try to build an empire and see how far I could take this thing. And so I was having 5 to 7 games a week and I couldn't control all of them. There was just too much poker. And, you know, I had to write a couple really big checks for people that had stiffed. And so I made a decision on one of the games that I was partnering with a different person to take a rake. And that was, you know, that was the beginning of the end. So
before we talk about how much you got in trouble over that,
Okay.
Explain to my listeners how, if you didn't take a cut, you made money on the game in L.A.
Well, both in L.A. and New York, I had, you know, my game in L.A. was $50,000 buy-in. My big game in New York was a $250,000 buy-in. And I just made sure to seat those, you know, 9 or 10 seats with the right people. And, you know, business flourished at the games. People were doing movie deals together. People were investing in each other's hedge funds. They had access to celebrity. They had access to, you know, a lot of money. And there was limited seats and almost what seemed like an unlimited amount of people that wanted to play. So the people that were in the game started tipping well to kind of secure their seats.
We got to stay in Molly's good graces because we have to come back to this game because this guy is going to be here and he's a giant fish. I want his money and she's my gatekeeper, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So they would grease your palms first with a little bit of money and then eventually as the game got bigger with a lot of money. So at some nights you were taking home tens of thousands of dollars in tips between you and your dealer, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, but then you got to New York and you got greedy and you decided to take a rake. Is that what got you in trouble?
Yes.
Okay. Is that why the FBI eventually took you down?
Yes.
Because I thought it was the Brad Ruderman connection. This guy, you talked about hedge funds. This guy was running a hedge fund that turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. And a lot of the people who were there eventually got named. Some of the celebrities who you name in your book got named in lawsuits from other people who were ripped off by this guy who felt like, well, how come Tobey Maguire has some of my money that I gave to this hedge fund guy, right?
Right, correct. Brad lost $5.2 or $5.3 million. And, you know, then when the government actually, when he got indicted federally, the government came and tried to recoup that $5 million that he had lost in the game. And, you know, he was a bad player and he wrote checks to almost every single person that sat at my table. And every person that received a check from him was getting sued. So that's why all this came out. This was how people found out publicly about the game and about the celebrities that played in it.
Yeah, I've talked to some of my poker-playing friends about this, especially when the story first came out. And we all said immediately, all those big-time stars, they're going to settle because they do not want to talk about this. Is that what happened?
It is. I think every single person in the case settled.
But was that part of the FBI case against you, or was it all the rake thing in New York?
It was all the rake thing in New York.
Aha. Did they come to you for details on what happened in your game when Brad was there?
Yeah, they came to me a couple different times, and I just, you know, declined to engage. So
you have
eventually.
You have not cooperated with the authorities at all on any of these games, right?
Never.
Okay. So was it last December that you pled guilty, or were you convicted, or what
yes,
happened?
Yes, I pled guilty.
Okay.
To running running an illegal gambling business was the specific charge.
And the punishment you're facing is?
Well, I was looking at 5 to 10 years, which is what they initially said when they arrested me. But I just got sentenced and I got a year of probation.
A year of probation.
It was pretty awesome. You know, it was shocking to me when the feds came because, number one, I never knew that I was breaking a federal law. I thought it was taking a break was a state misdemeanor, which is what my attorney at the time told me, who used to be a federal prosecutor. And second of all, I hadn't run a game in 2 years. So, you know, it was really sort of kind of out of left field. So
is the game still going on?
Not in the same way. The games became sort of more disjointed. The players spread out. I hear about two guys that play heads up sometimes for like $100 million.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
$100 million?
In one night, I heard that this guy lost $100 million in one night playing heads up. And those are two guys, one, you know, that I found in New York and the other guy that I found in L.A. And I think they still play heads up. But, you know, it's such a compulsive thing and you keep raising the stakes. You're going to turn it into just a billionaire's game. And then it just became two guys that could play at that level. So.
Right. And that is just about greed and not really about poker.
No, it's not about poker.
And also not about the fun, because some of these guys came to the game and they weren't looking to, you know, get it all in on every hand.
No.
They wanted to hang out and have fun, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was trying to recruit players, it was selling a lifestyle as much as it was selling this game.
Some of the other people who played in your game, Leonardo DiCaprio, Gabe Kaplan, Guy La Liberté from Cirque du Soleil, the list was very long.
Yes.
With all of these connections to all of these different people, who's making the movie?
Well,
I know it's not going to be Tobey Maguire.
You never know. Weirder things have happened. no, probably not. So we'll see. You know, I think it's I think it lends itself very, very easily to some sort of movie or cable, you know, television series. So I've been kind of exploring that, finding who the right storyteller would be.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because when I was reading the book yesterday, I thought you could do more than just 90 minutes in a movie with this, because there's so much to tell.
It's the world, you know, it's the underground world that is shrouded in secrecy and, you know, of not only high stakes poker, but just high stakes gambling and all that excess. And
I can hear the casting call now. We're looking for somebody to play a greedy movie superstar. Who's in? No names. The book is called Molly's Game, From Hollywood's Elite to Wall Street's Billionaire Boys Club, My High-Stakes Adventure in the World of Underground Poker. Molly Bloom, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking to you as well.